You're listening to KSCO Santa Cruz, Salinas, Monterey, and San Jose, and 104 FM. This is From the Bookshelf. I'm Gary Shapiro. Thanks for joining me. In a little bit, we're going to talk with Kate Winkler Dawson about her new book, Death in the Air, the true story of a serial killer, the great London smog, and the strangling of a city. But first, I want to welcome Hilary Rail back to the show. Hilary Rail is a novelist whose first novel, Lessons in French, was published a few years ago, and she was here to talk about it. And her new book is called Kids Like Us, and it's so great that as soon as I finished it, I asked Hilary Rail to come back and talk to us about her new book. Hilary Rail, welcome back to From the Bookshelf.
Thank you so much for having me. I'm delighted.
So tell us what we need to know so we can get into a conversation about Kids Like Us.
Well, Kids Like Us is from the point of view of a 16-year-old boy named Martin. He is on the autistic spectrum. He's lives in California and goes to, or in Los Angeles, and goes to a special school for kids on the spectrum. And his mother is a very successful film director, and she is directing a movie in France on location in the Loire Valley in the French countryside, sort of a big historical epic. And she takes Martin and his older sister Elizabeth with her to on the shoot for 2 months. And Martin's father, who is not present for reasons that you don't know in the beginning of the book, was French. And so Martin's fluent in French. But this is the first time he's ever actually been to France. And not only that, but it's the first time that he's ever been to a school for typical kids, or a sort of general ed school, as you call it. So he attends this regular high school in the French countryside for these 2 months while his mom is shooting this movie, and he meets a girl who is what we call neurotypical, like all the other kids in the school. And he, in his mind, when he first meets her, she is a character from his favorite book. And a lot of kids on the spectrum will have a narrative that sort of frames the world for them, and through which, usually in like incredibly intelligent and perceptive ways, they'll like interpret experience. And for some, it can be train schedules, and for some, for one really famous case, it was Disney movies. And for Martin, it happens to be the first volume of Proust's In Search of Lost Time. But even if you've never read it, which a lot of my audience hasn't because most of them are teenagers, it doesn't matter. It's the book through which he sees the world. And it's a book about trying to recapture the past. So it's like thematically, it's a beautiful book and sort of works with the narrative. But Martin loves this book, and it's essentially a love story. And he believes at first that he has met the girl, Gilberte, who is the love interest of the narrator of the book. And then as the story progresses, he realizes that she is not Gilberte. And it's sort of through this series of painful yet beautiful revelations, he comes to see that he's fallen in love with a real person. And they sort of breach the neurological divide between them and have what they call a neurodiverse romance. and I think it ultimately is, it's not a story about him growing out of who he is. It's a story about him growing into who he is and learning to love and appreciate himself, and also to love and appreciate someone who's really different from him, which I think is really important.
Well, you mentioned that many of your readers are teenagers, and you told me that this book has been designated a young adult book, and it's mm-hmm. been, what is it, Amazon chose it as the greatest young adult book ever written or something like that?
The absolute greatest one ever written, yes.
Yeah.
That's what they said.
Well, I mean, I must be a young adult because I was completely absorbed by it, and I didn't find that I was, you know, I didn't think there were, well, for one thing, it doesn't take place in a dystopian future, so I don't see how it could be a young adult.
there are no trolls and there are no vampires.
but also, you know, there was nothing that I felt was written down in any way to any age group. So how was it designated a young adult? Was that a decision that you made, or your publishers, or what?
It was as the story began to take shape. people started suggesting to me that because of the perspective, it should be a young adult novel. And I, at first, I was a little confused because some of the themes didn't strike me as young adult, especially the Proust. But then I completely embraced it when I realized that young adult books are books about identity so much of the time. And that's what this is. And also that you don't have to write down to teenagers. Like, teenagers are omnivorous and they're curious and they want to read all kinds of stuff. And if they don't understand something, they're less likely to reject it than an adult who doesn't understand it is, I think. Like, the kids who read the Proust, some of them read about the Proust, or some of them are intrigued. And then for some of them, that's just, you know, the book that he was obsessed with. And they don't need to go any deeper than that. And they're much more interested in whether or not autism is a disease to be cured, or an identity like being gay, like your sexuality, and those kinds of questions, that identity questions that teenagers wrestle with. So once I embraced the idea of making it young adult, it made sense to me. But I also feel like it's a very fluid designation. I mean, I wonder if Catcher in the Rye would be young adult now, or you know, To Kill a Mockingbird. I mean, not that I'm comparing myself to those books, but just that books that adults have traditionally read, like I'm sure you have, you know, as not thinking of them for any age, would now be classified as young adult.
So were there any restrictions? Did they tell you, oh, you can't have a sentence this long, or you have to take out this subject matter?
The one thing they had me do, which I actually thought was good, was to trim down a lot of the Proust. Because I have a degree in French literature. I love Proust. And I went down in the original draft a fair number of rabbit holes that I thought were fascinating. But I don't know if they really were to anyone else. And I think what I did when I made the final decision to make it young adult, there was almost nothing I had to change, but I did force myself to only use the Proust in service of the story, which I think I should have done from the very beginning, because it just made it a much better book. So I think making it young adult for that reason was a great service to the story. Yeah, I think also, I mean, I'm hoping that people, I mean, not only parents, but just people who think about how you relate to kids will be interested in it. How you talk to them and how you think about them and how you have to realize that they're not, whether you're their parent or their teacher or their mentor or their friend, they're not an extension of you, and that can be really painful. And so I think that there's some in the relationship between Martin and his mother and his father. I just think there's a lot of stuff to, I mean, I hope there's a lot of stuff for anyone to think about.
Well, Hillary Rail, tell us a little bit about how you personally got interested in autism.
Well, I have I have three amazing daughters, and the youngest one is somewhere on the autistic spectrum, and watching her learn language has been just the most beautiful, moving experience. It's sort of like taking the face off a clock, because she doesn't learn intuitively the way that we do. She's super smart, but she learns things deliberately. Like, she memorizes phrases, first kind of repeats them in an almost nonsensical way, and then starts to apply them in very smart ways to her world, and eventually makes them her own. And so when she was little, she would just take, you know, memorize books and songs and take phrases of them from them and just use these memorized phrases to describe the world. And I just thought that was so beautiful. And so cool. And now she's doing it so quickly that you're hardly aware of it. But I know how hard she worked. And I also know how poetic her mind is. And so I got this voice in my head of an older kid who learned the way that I perceived her learning and had a, you know, narrative, and I just made it a more sophisticated book that I happen to be in love with. But it was sort of, it's a love letter to her, and it kind of grew out of my admiration for her, even though it's not an autobiographical book at all. But you know, she and her amazing little mind were the seed. And then I also, as a mother of somebody who's just completely different from me, and that was really hard at first and really, really scary. That, you know, I wondered, like, am I ever going to be able to communicate with her across this divide because we think so differently? And, you know, and so I've had to, like, think a lot about myself and my own assumptions, and it's been painful, but it's also just been this incredible growth experience. So I wanted to show the people around Martin growing to admire him and to figure him out and to see what was wonderful about him. So it was partly that, also just sort of the wonder that can surround a totally different kind of person. So it was just all these different themes, but really, really sparked by her.
Well, when you first discovered that your daughter was on the autism scale, how did you discover it, and did you hope she would get better, or what were your thoughts?
Well, so that's a really great question. I did. I sort of hoped, you know, that somehow we could cure this and we could get it gone and we could, you know, get all the therapy and make it go away rather than give her, it's a very fine line because you want to respect her and celebrate her for who she is. You also want to give her the tools to communicate in the world and to have friends and to not alienate people. So you're just constantly adjusting between your own desire to make her acceptable so that she's not in pain, and then your desire to just celebrate her uniqueness. So obviously my first reaction was like, this is terrible, what can we do, what have I done, you know, just all the usual stuff, and then, or not usual, but what you would expect, but it's really evolved. And I've also done a lot of reading by mostly online by young autistic people who celebrate autism and celebrate their difference, and there's so much cool stuff out there and so much cool thought and just embracing identity and diversity and just this whole world that I never would have discovered. So I'm really grateful.
Well, as you were saying earlier, one of the themes in Kids Like Us is the idea that, from Martin's point of view, that, you know, the other half of the world wants us to be like them, right, instead of embracing us for who we are and the things that we have. And that's kind of, you know, one of the most beautiful messages, I think, in the book, and you do it so well. But what about the I don't know how to say it. Is there an autistic community that has read the book and reacted to it?
So, more and more, yeah. Actually, there have been a couple of wonderful reviews by people on the autistic spectrum. In fact, if you go on my website, the very first review is by an autistic Australian blogger, and it's called Paper Fury. And it's amazing, and she, there's not so much. It's interesting. The reactions that I've gotten from the autistic community are, you know, this is accurate, not so much because there is one accurate way to portray an autistic person, but because he's a complete character with some autistic traits, who has a romance and who, you know, is, even though he's high functioning, he has stimulating behaviors and but he's also a good athlete, which is atypical. People seem to really react to the fact of his being a complete person and a character before being autistic. Does that make sense?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
You also found a lot of humor in this story.
Yeah. And I also got, there's another British blogger, too, his name is James Sinclair, and he has a site called Autistic and Unapologetic. And he, too, was just like, you know, this is the best autistic character I've read this year. And it made me happy because I was a little bit nervous about taking on the voice. But I felt like I wasn't trying to represent a type. This was just a unique person who happened to have some of these traits, and I think that's why it's worked.
And of course, you say it's not autobiographical, but at the same time, it takes place in France, where you have spent a lot of time and written about previously. His mother is a film director, and your father was a film director,
right?
And so there's some things that are kind of...
Yeah, there's definitely...
You write what you know, I guess.
Yeah, you do definitely write what you know. There's also a lot of cooking in it and a lot of French food, which is my
answer.
Yeah, and also the literary references and that piece of music that he listens to obsessively, that violin and piano sonata that he listens to, is one of my favorite, too. So there's definitely, you know, there's... I'm definitely in there, but it's...
Now, your two older daughters, they're 15?
Mm-hmm, they're 15, they're twins.
And have they read the book?
They have. They have one of them. I actually had them read it, and they were incredibly helpful just for, you know, tone, vocabulary, social media stuff. Not that Martin's particularly active on social media, but I just wanted to... make sure that the other kids were, and I just wanted to make sure that I got that right. But I mostly wanted to see if they cared about him, and I think they did. So and I think partly it might have been a little bit intense for them because of their sister, and also because it's me. But they both read it straight through and told me they liked it. It's interesting. Most of the kids their age who I've talked to about it, the scene that really, one of the scenes that really impacts them is the one where Martin's trying to explain to his mother, who just wants him to be happy but can't quite conceive that her notion of happiness, because she's such a social person, isn't his, and he says to her, "Mom, what if I were gay? Like, would you want to cure me?" And the kids can really, really relate to that moment in the story. I think just because for all of them, it's so much about identity and coming of age. So that was one moment that marked my girls that they talked to me about.
Well, so Hilary Rael, do you think that you're going to continue with your next book? Will it be a young adult book?
I think it will. I think I want to do a couple more. I've been really impressed with the young adult audience and also the young adult writing community, and the engagement with young adults is just so profound and sort of meaningful, and people come up to you and they're... my first school visit in Charleston, I was with another writer who's really famous, and a girl just came up to her and started weeping. You know, it's like, because her book had changed her life. I mean, it's just, so that, I feel like I'd love to sort of bask in that intensity for a couple more books, and then maybe I'll go back to writing for grown-ups. But again, I don't, as you say, I think that the designations can be kind of arbitrary. You know, so many adults read young adults. And so much young adult stuff is just fantastic and really sophisticated.
Well, you can certainly say that about this book, which is called Kids Like Us, and the author, Hilary Rael. Thank you so much for spending some time with us on From the Bookshelf.
Thank you. It's been wonderful. Thank you so much, Gary.
Hilary Rael. Her new book is called Kids Like Us. After the break, I will talk with Kate Winkler Dawson. She's the author of Death in the Air, the true story of a serial killer, the great London smog, and the strangling of a city. I'm Gary Shapiro. This is From the Bookshelf. We'll be right back. I'm Gary Shapiro. This is From the Bookshelf on KSCO. My next guest is Kate Winkler Dawson. Kate Winkler Dawson is a crime historian and a reporter whose new book is really two stories of death, and it's called Death in the Air, the true story of a serial killer, the great London smog, and the strangling of a city. Kate Winkler Dawson, welcome to From the Bookshelf.
Thank you for having me.
Gosh, Kate Winkler Dawson, you must be a lot of fun.
I am, yes, actually.
You say in your notes that you're a devotee of those crime shows.
I am, very much. My background is kind of interesting. I'm not just a true crime fanatic, although I am. As you mentioned, I was a television news producer, and so I spent a lot of time on crime stories. I covered the Gary Condit case, you know, the state representative from California. I'm sure you all know well, who was suspected of killing his intern. So I covered that case in Central California in Modesto for 3 or 4 months until September 11th happened. And so, you know, I have a sort of an expertise, I think, in true crime and crime cases. But my father was a law professor at the University of Texas for 37 years. He specialized in criminal law. And so he and I spent, you know, most of my years, starting from when I was about 9 or 10, talking about crime and justice and how the law works and where it doesn't work. So it's all sort of, I'm many layers, Gary. That's how we ended up with death, with death in the air.
Nothing will bring a father and daughter together like murder.
Murder.
But Death in the Air, the true story of a serial killer and the great London smog and the strangling of a city, it's a fine piece of literature, and it's not at all lurid in the way that some of the crime shows that you love are. So talk a little bit about your literary influences.
Well, you know, there were many. So it's, again, strangely, like many things, goes back to your childhood. So about a month and a half ago, I was at my mother's house, which was my childhood home, and I was looking at the bookshelves that I've looked at my entire life, and it was, the books were, of course, Stephen King, Dean Koontz, and then I noticed there was In Cold Blood, and just, there were no happy stories in any of the books my mother read, and I, you know, I've been surrounded by these books forever, but, you know, I think that there are some classic books that are, I think are amazing, sort of the more academic in nature. Christine Horton wrote an incredible book called London Fog, a biography, that sort of tracks the literature and fog's influence on literature. It was a beautiful book. But then, you know, I'm a huge fan of historical true crime. So I think, you know, I'm a fan of Douglas Preston, of course, Eric Larson, and there are, you know, just many others who I think have been really incredible in this genre, where you're elevating true crime so that you're really plunking people down into an important time period. And I think people get a little fooled. You know, they jump into a book and they think, oh, it's going to be about the facts of the case and who killed who. And it's, historical true crime's not just that. I mean, you are being drawn into a world, not just the world of your killer and your victims, but of the people who surround them, and I think that's what really gives readers so much excitement when, wow, how am I learning about the subway system of the 1950s and learning about, you know, our murder and about sulfur dioxide and, you know, how acid rain is created. So there's a lot going on in historical true crime books.
Well, Jan Morris, although she was James Morris at the time, she famously wrote of two events of that period in the book Coronation Everest, which told the story of the conquest of Everest by Hillary and the coronation of Queen Elizabeth II. And it kind of made me think of that. So you took these two events and you wrote about them both. What made you put them together in this way?
You know, it was interesting because this was not going to be a true crime book at all. I was looking at different
parts of the internet that I would normally look at to look for a book idea, which for me, it might be a little strange to people listening, but for me, I love to go to Getty Images and Associated Press Images and flip through their editorial section and their sort of major news sections, historical. So I'm particularly interested in from the 1950s back. Anything past the 1950s, I'm not particularly, you know, interested in that era. And so I ran across this photo of this gorgeous woman in black and white with a scarf wrapped around her face, and she looks sort of frightened, and there she's surrounded by fog. And I read the caption, and it said, you know, 1952 smog, and it was a model shoot for a magazine that was released the next year, you know, that was pro clean air, anti-pollution. And so I, instead of going to read about the great smog, I actually looked for more pictures. And so I found more pictures of the great smog and just realized how beautiful the photos were and how incredible, what kind of story they told. And then I decided to read more about the fog. And as I decided that this would be a book I would want to write about the great smog of 1952, I needed characters. And so I managed to locate some people who are still alive, who survived. And I found some really great notes and letters from people who had died, who are also characters in my book. And I needed more background, though. I had a politician who was the champion for clean air at the time, Norman Dodds, and I was searching the newspaper archives for his debates in Parliament, for any stories, frankly, about the great smog. And so I was searching in the March of 1953 sections of the Times of London, of the New York Times, of any newspaper that was around. And I was inundated with headlines like "The Beast of Rillington Place," "Body under the Parlor," "Two Skeletons in the Back Garden," and these headlines just kept coming, and there was no fog. I mean, there just were no stories about the fog, and I couldn't, and really no search. We were in Korea. The UK was in Korea at the time, and it was, there were very few stories about that. I mean, it was incredible how this one lunatic serial killer had taken over the newspapers all over the world, in the United States also. And so it just occurred to me, well, I wonder if these two somehow fit together, because they certainly fit together in the media. And then I realized that there were so many debates happening in Parliament over the death penalty because of the serial killer, that the debates of the fog had, you know, for lack of a better word, dissipated. And so this was sort of, I think it was probably around this time when I had been thinking about, as a journalist, how disappointed I've been, especially as of late, of every time there is some sort of a outlandish tweet from a politician or from anyone, frankly, in the public eye, how derailed we become as a society in the media over, you know, a salacious story like a serial killer, when there are very real big problems happening, like, you know, issues with the EPA, criminal justice, you know, North Korea. I mean, there are large problems that I think are completely derailed in the media and in the public eye thanks to sexier stories. And John Reginald Christie was a sexy story in the 1950s, and the fog wasn't. So I just thought this was a fantastic juxtaposition of two killers who couldn't be more different, but they collide, and that's what a braided narrative is. You tell these two stories alongside each other, and eventually end up colliding, and these two stories collided in the media in 1953. And I just kept thinking, how could you, as a public, just be so enamored, not just enamored, but scared of one person who killed six, maybe eight people? The extra two are debatable, versus a fog that killed, at the time it was believed 4,000, but really was 12,000. So it just seemed ludicrous to me that just one was more feared than the other, and I really wanted to know why. And the easiest way was to tell both stories at the same time.
Kate Winkler Dawson, do you think that it was in the government's interest that people were more obsessed with the events of 10 Rillington Place than they were about the air around them?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, I think that it is, as a for government officials, for politicians, for the public, for the media, it is much easier to be concerned about a clear and present danger that will eventually rectify itself. I mean, he was caught, and then, you know, justice went forward, and there was a trial, and there was testimony. But air pollution in the 1950s, much as it is now, is a very complicated, messy, systemic problem that takes decades or more to solve. And that's if you have willing parties willing to solve this, and they didn't at the time. So I could absolutely see how it's easier to focus on sort of a solvable problem than something that seems so overwhelming to a government that was bankrupt thanks to World War II. It was not, smokeless fuel was not something that was really attainable. It wasn't a reasonable to think that everyone in London would be able to switch over to oil or gas or electricity. It just wasn't economically feasible. So, yeah, I think a nice distraction was certainly what the government had hoped for.
I'm Gary Shapiro. This is From the Bookshelf. We're talking with Kate Winkler-Dawson. She's the author of Death in the Air, the true story of a serial killer, the Great London Smog, and the strangling of a city. Kate Winkler-Dawson, can you tell us how this anti-cyclone caused this Great London Smog?
Sure. So I would have not thought that a high-pressure system would ever lead to such death and destruction, but it did. And that's what's so interesting. So, you know, this high-pressure system formed on the Gulf Stream, which happens all the time, and it's, you know, just a weather system that is called, can be called an anticyclone when it lands over a city. So it floats over London around December 4th, which was a Thursday, and it was one of the coldest days of the year. So you've got more than 8 million people, you know, I said the world's most populated city, 8 million people burning coal. So this isn't your nice black, quote-unquote, clean coal. We know there's no such thing as clean coal. But this is brown, crumbly, low-carbon, high-moisture, brown coal called nutty slack. And it was mostly dust with some kind of pathetic nuggets of coal mixed in. And it was sold to Londoners because the other coal, the black coal, was rationed, and then it was also at the same time being sold overseas, so it just wasn't available. So it took about four times the amount of nutty slack to burn and create the same amount of peat as the same sort of amount of black coal. So this was really nasty stuff. It created a lot of smoke, a lot of smoke particles, a lot of sulfur dioxide, and every nasty chemical you could think of that comes from burning coal. And it produced very little heat. So about 4 days before the anti-cyclone moved over London, the British government lifted the rations on this nasty brown stuff and said, here you go. I know it's getting cold outside. Burn as much as you want. So you have 8 million people burning cheap, dirty coal. You have 20,000 steam-powered locomotives that are burning coal. And you've got 40 coal-burning power plants in London alone, in the city of London alone. And then the government had just gotten rid of its electric tram system over the summer and replaced it with those beautiful double-decker red buses that are kind of iconic with London, except they burn diesel. So you have an awful lot of cars on top of that. It's just sort of this perfect storm of pollution, which always made people sick, and people died every year. However, this was an anomaly because this high-pressure system settled over London, and normally what would happen is, you know, in a high-pressure system, the cold, moist air stays at the bottom at the ground level, and it is trapped by a level of warm air at the top. So the fog is created, and, of course, whatever's in the air at the time is going to mix, and it creates a smog. Now, if some low-pressure system comes behind this anticyclone and pushes it away, all the air pollution is able to go into the atmosphere, and the air clears out, and then the cycle, of course, can begin at some point when another high-pressure system comes around. But there's always a wind or something that can move along this high-pressure system. And unfortunately, there was no wind for five very long days, so about 100 hours worth of suffering with record levels of pollution, levels that were so high that the government's monitoring systems were disabled because of the amount of pollution in the air. They weren't able to measure them, and all of the government's measurements, ironically, in Westminster, which is where Parliament is, those were hit the most. When I got the government reports back from the Ministry of Air, which is, you know, the meteorology groups, all of the levels near Westminster said nil, 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 nil. And it's not because there was no pollution. It's that the little disclaimer at the bottom says it's because we couldn't get a reading because it came out black. We couldn't even get a reading for what the levels were. So it was pretty incredible. It lasted 5 days. It was a disgusting, horrible yellow haze that smelled like rotten eggs. You couldn't see your hand basically from your wrist out if you stuck it straight out. You couldn't see your legs. It was very disconcerting and disorienting, and, you know, your eyes burned and your throat burned and your nose burned. And on top of that, you couldn't really tell who was out there and where you were going. And when you get inside the house, it just doesn't stop. And I covered in Northern California when I was at San Francisco. I covered wildfires. And, you know, I remember we get wildfires here in Texas, and I remember covering wildfires in Northern California and going back to my hotel, which was probably, you know, I don't know, 20 miles away, something like that from wherever we were stationed. And the smell was on me. It was coming through the windows. You just can't get away from fumes. You can't stop fumes. And in these houses in London that had been bombed, many of them were sort of rickety. The glass was broken. The window panes were cracked, and they were just defenseless against this stuff. Sulfur dioxide is stopped by nothing, and it'll just float in, and it killed up to 12,000 people. Many of them were already sick. Many of them were elderly, lived by themselves, and so it was a real tragedy. And I think the memo that upset me sort of the most of the hundreds to probably about 1,000 different memos that I read was within the Ministry of Health, there was a medical official who essentially said in British speak that, well, most of these people were going to die anyway.
In British speak. was this the worst in history? Had there ever been one as bad before? And were there ever any that bad again?
So this was the world's deadliest air pollution disaster. It's unlikely, we hope, to ever be usurped, but certainly China and India are, and Pakistan are certainly, you know, vying for second or third place because it's a really bad situation in those countries too. And so the precedent is in Belgium in 1938, something similar happened with a zinc factory. Now I can't remember, of course. But the one that was the biggest news happened in 1948 in the United States. So this is 4 years before the Great Smog in 1948. So a anticyclone, just like the one in London, settled over Denora, Pennsylvania, which was a small mining town, or small town, a little bit outside of Pittsburgh. And most of the town was employed by U.S. Steel, and there was a zinc plant there, which, of course, emitted horrible pollution into the air. And when this anticyclone landed in October of 1948, it again created a lid, fog formed, pollution mixed with all of the moist air created the smog, and it killed 20 people and sickened 100,000. And what's so interesting was the reaction from the difference between what happened in Denora and how the people there reacted to the reaction of people in London. So in Denora, when you read the accounts, it was like a natural disaster happened. I mean, it was triage units in churches and ambulances going everywhere. And, I mean, really, the whole town started to go in lockdown to try to save people and to really get people, try to evacuate people out of the town. I mean, they realized that this was a disaster. And that's not even remotely what happened in London. And I think it's the difference between the two areas, perhaps the two countries, was again with London, sort of the historical background. Fogs have been around for hundreds of years, ever since the 16th century when London expanded and cut down many of the trees and wood wasn't available, they had to turn to coal. And ever since then, the skies have been blackened by fog, by smog. And in Dunora, that just wasn't the case. I mean, there were always fumes from smelting plants and, you know, from U.S. steel, but it wasn't the same. And so the reaction had been interesting. After these people, there were 20 people who died, thousands were sick. There was a U.S. federal investigation. The United States government refused to lay blame at the feet of U.S. steel, and U.S. steel said, this is a natural phenomenon. You can't blame us for the weather, but we will pay you millions of dollars to settle a lawsuit. And now there's a museum in Dunora dedicated to this event, and nothing like that in London. It's just two very different situations. But the air pollution experts in London were very well aware of what happened in Dunora. And in fact, my politician in the book, Norman Dodds, who's the champion of clean air, used the report, the federal report from America, as a way to really try to beat Churchill's government into submission over the 1952 smog. He said, this is what the U.S. government did. They launched an investigation. They hired experts. And what did you all do? You haven't done anything. So it was a very important precedent set there. And, you know, when ultimately what happened with the 1952 smog is it became the impetus for the 1956 Clean Air Act, which was the world's first comprehensive federal air pollution legislation. So it created, you know, across the nation, across the UK, smokeless zones. It forced the government to provide subsidies to households to convert their coal fireplaces to be able to accept, you know, oil or gas or electricity. So it was really a big step forward. And then the U.S. followed suit in 1970 with its own Clean Air Act. So there was sort of like a interesting exchange between both countries. And I found many memos between the United States and Britain trying to swap information. But certainly the U.S. government seemed to be more proactive about air pollution. Not much, much more, but more than what the British government did. The U.K. just wanted it to go away. Churchill's cabinet just wanted the whole issue to go away. They didn't want to deal with it. There were bigger, much bigger problems.
Like a serial killer. So both of the both of the events that happen in your book, Death in the Air, led to lasting legal changes.
Yes. Yeah, I think they were both important. And that, and with the serial killer, again, I mean, I think John Reginald Christie as a criminal is interesting. And I think his characteristics are interesting. But I think the case is fascinating because of the impact it had on law. And certainly, I think the impact that it had on the public. And it was just such a clear contrast between two stories, one that should have been just screaming on the front page of every newspaper ever since it happened in December, and the fog just wasn't. And then, yes, a serial killer stalking people for 6 or 7 days is important, but after that you would think interest would wane, and it certainly did not wane for about 6 months after he was finally caught.
Well, this book is extremely compelling, and it's called Death in the Air: The True Story of a Serial Killer, The Great London Smog, and the Strangling of a City. And the author, my guest, Kate Winkler Dawson. Kate Winkler Dawson, thank you so much for spending some time with us on From the Bookshelf.
Thank you.
Well, that's it for this week's From the Bookshelf. I hope you enjoyed the program, and we'll come back and see us again next week. In the meantime, check out our podcast page at fromthebookshelf.com. You can subscribe to the podcast at iTunes or wherever you subscribe to podcasts. You can like us on Facebook. I want to thank my guests, Hilary Rail. Her novel is called Kids Like Us. And Kate Winkler Dawson. Her book is called Death in the Air, The True Story of a Serial Killer, The Great London Smog, and the Strangling of a City. From the Bookshelf is produced by Francis Venegas and Ollie Jackson. I'm Gary Shapiro. Thanks so much for listening, and we'll see you next time.